Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Welcome back to the tailgate podcast. Nick Osello, you know what's not in the background right now?
What's that?
Contrary to many of our listeners' requests and wishes, we are not watching the Notre Dame Fighting Irish conclude their 14-9 win over the University of Maryland on Sunday afternoon because we have a new sworn enemy of this podcast, and it is who exactly?
United Airlines. We're staging a boycott. The lacrosse community, I'm rallying the troops. We're forming a well-regulated militia and boycotting United Airlines. There's no directs from anywhere to Boise, so I'm flying out of San Diego this morning. First off, their economy ticket is whatever the price is, but it doesn't come with a carry-on bag. Found that out and then had to rush through where it was like, hey, they wouldn't let me check in online. Oh, yeah, you have to check your carry-on. I'm like, bitch, what? $40 to check a carry-on bag that I thought was going to be free, which puts me late. And then the flight in San Diego is fine. And then I'm sitting at LAX for 15
You flew from
hours.
San Diego to LAX?
San Diego to LAX, LAX
no
to
way.
Boise. Yeah, Diego, LAX. I've done it three times now. You just get to cruising altitude, come back down, and then they're like, here's where the big boys are going to take you all the way to the promised land. And so the first flight is just 4 hours because you have to get there in the security. It's just for nothing. Like, you're just wasting time there. And then, oh, we're going to put you on the plane, but we're also going to delay it. And then we're going to text you, and I just want to read this out loud for the listeners because I couldn't believe that this was the reason. Flight, blah, 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 from Los Angeles to Boise is delayed further because your crew has not had sufficient rest time required by federal law. It now departs at 10:45, which it didn't. Not sufficient rest time. They needed a nappy. I had to
wait
while
they took
a nappy. Do
you think that they pressed the snooze and just forgot to wake up?
Something
was it the radio alarm?
Yeah, it was, you know, they probably...
Like people are going to get that joke. I'm going to be very excited.
I have no clue, but they probably fell asleep with their phone on Do Not Disturb, and somebody was calling them, and then now all of a sudden, federal regulations. So, bottom line, I didn't get to see a lot of the, or any, outside of some clips that I was watching of the Notre Dame-Maryland game. What I did see, however, Terry, and this is where we're going to start, is... I love it. Can you tell me a more electric environment than when Notre Dame's football team shows up? And what people don't talk about enough, I think Patrick McEwen was given a shout out to it, is the proximity and how close you are to the players. And to share a quick anecdote before I shut up and let listeners actually hear about something that they want to hear about, my senior year, every one of my college roommates, I didn't live with any college lacrosse players. I lived with the NARPs so that they could do my homework. Thanks, Paul. They came to the game with the sole intention that they wanted to try and get kicked out by like the 89-year-old usher who's just there volunteering his time. And so they would say horrific stuff all the time. Not only could we hear it on the field, Coach Corrigan could hear it. He had to talk because Will, my teammate, his son, wonder how that happened, they were like his childhood friends from South Bend. And so they had to like have my friends over and say, hey guys, we're hearing everything that you're screaming. So just know that when they're along that hill, you can hear everything that is being yelled. So with that said, Notre Dame, Maryland, what's more electric than that?
There was one particular person among the group that... It's possible all of these guys are 6'5", and if that's the case, this guy was 5'9". And if it's possible that these guys were like 6'1", is there a player on the Notre Dame football team that's like 5'5", 3'10"?
No, I didn't see
He took his shirt
guy.
Off at the end of the game, by the way, so he's very easy to pick out.
Do you know if there's any... Where would I find this? What would I search on Twitter? Did anybody repost it?
I think you have to direct message Dan Abram for this level of incredible content.
No, but I am screaming to find that as soon as we're done recording here because he already sounds like my favorite athlete of all time.
So I think Jordan Faison is his favorite athlete of all time, because every time the freshman wide receiver on the football team, I don't know if you heard, but you're apparently allowed to play both at Notre Dame.
Chad DeBolt paved the way. Yeah. So
did Chad DeBolt pay you to say that?
No, but yeah, per NCAA regulations, listeners, if you're listening to this, you can't actually play both. So Jordan Faison is technically a club player who got a 1-year exemption to play on the varsity team. I'm making shit up and talking out of my
ass. Yeah, this is a terrible bit. We've driven this far into the ground. That being said, yeah, so I came into this game wondering, well, I'll put it this way. I picked Maryland because I felt like Georgetown beat Notre Dame on the basis of their game plan, which was, I mean, to torture a football analogy a little bit farther, they wanted to run the ball, control time of possession, make their 50-yard field goals, and score touchdowns every time they got into the red zone. And that's what they did. And that was why they won, right? They played it as close as possible, went to overtime, and they won. I don't know if you saw. Actually, I do know that you saw, because I watched you watch it. So I was like, A, that's kind of Maryland's identity anyway. B, I'm sure John Tillman is going to watch Georgetown's film and say, like, all right, if that worked against Notre Dame, then we're more incentivized to do that and employ that game plan than we might otherwise be. And then C, who historically is better at executing their team's game plans than Maryland? So now, by virtue of the way the game unfolded, what I realize is that I didn't give enough credit to Notre Dame for the way in which they were going to adjust. And I think it's important to try to figure out exactly how Notre Dame was able to turn a game that last week featured 65 possessions. So Notre Dame had the ball 34 times, Georgetown had the ball 31 times in a game that went to overtime. This week, Notre Dame had the ball 44 times and Maryland had the ball 33 times, meaning that there were 12 more possessions in two fewer minutes in this week's games. And that matters for a lot of reasons, but the biggest reason that it matters is because if you have the better offense and you give them the ball more, you're going to score more goals than your opponent. And the second reason that it matters more for Notre Dame than it might for a lot of other opponents is because they're really deep. And they need to get guys opportunities to get runs, particularly that second midfield with the likes of Jalen Seymour and Riley Gray and now Will Engrick and Bryce Walker. And it was very clear that those guys didn't get a rhythm, and it kind of disrupted the first midfield line's rhythm a little bit as well against Georgetown. And you know, when you combine that with the job that Ty Banks did in guarding Pat Kavanaugh, it just rolled up into a game where they were limited to 10, right? And conversely, so the fact that Notre Dame went 50% as a team facing off against Maryland, which, do you remember? Basically, it was pretty much like the first podcast that we did. We talked about Will Lynch, and I was like, dude, he's a freshman. Don't worry about it. He's going to get better. And he has gotten better. He went 66% against, you know, kind of consensus first-team All-American in this game today. It was a battle of the two goalies that I think are very clearly the best. I think we talked about it last week. I definitely wrote about it. Like, they, to me, are the U.S. national team goalies for the foreseeable future. And Liam Entman had a bounce-back performance that counteracted. He just played better than Logan McNaney. You know, he had 13 saves with 9 goals allowed. Flip that. And that's what McNaney had. He had 9 saves with 13 goals allowed. So, you know, it was very akin to the game that we're going to get to next in terms of, you know, talking to Lars Tiffany after their loss to Hopkins, he was like, we're used to being on the plus side of the special teams, the faceoffs, the goalies, and getting those possession advantage through the ride. Notre Dame is as well, and they weren't against Georgetown. Georgetown cleared 20 of 22. Maryland cleared 75%, right? That's 16% points worse than the Hoyas. And Pat Kavanaugh caused 4 turnovers. 4 turnovers. That's like an incredible day for a close defenseman. I don't even know. So in the way that we designed our fantasy game, you get 6 points for a caused turnover. Pat, you get 3 points for a goal and 3 points for an assist. So Pat Kavanaugh, I mean, he had like a Michael Vick against the Washington Commanders in like 2009 Monday Night Football type day. So it was an interesting game for being what I would describe as a relatively boring game. Maryland scored first. Notre Dame went up 4-1. Maryland scored late in the first quarter. And then it was 7-5 with about a minute to go in the first quarter. Notre Dame scored twice to make it 9-5. Faison had the first goal of the third, and then he scored again with like 2 minutes to go in the third to go up six. Maryland cut it to three, and then that was it. It just kind of coasted the rest of the way. So, you know, it raises an interesting question. I think if Maryland had won at 5-0, they would have clearly been the number one team in the country. Now that they're 4-1, Notre Dame's 4-1 or 3-1. There are a lot of teams with one loss, and there are, I think, five or six undefeated teams, two of which have meaningful wins, those being Denver and Army. And it's a really interesting conversation. It's one that's going
to
extend until
as far as who's number one, yeah, I would like to save that for the end.
The end.
Where
right.
we can recap the games, and that's – if you're coming here to listen to everybody, you know, me and Terry go back and forth about who should be number one, wait for that until the end. What I did think was interesting is I love looking at a slate of games, particularly the results, and then trying to draw like kind of vast conclusions. Like, what was the theme of the weekend? How did it turn out? What did it look like? And you hit on both of them. And it was pace and depth seemed to dictate a lot of the results of the game, which is going to be fascinating. And I think that Notre Dame has been the best example so far of making an adjustment from, okay, you know, we don't want to play that slow, run it down your throat, you know, that football analogy that you use. We kind of want to have that, let's get the Kavanaughs causing chaos and, you know, in the writing and clearing game. Let's press it. Let's try to get more possessions out there. So I feel like it's going to be interesting to keep tabs, and I'm going to try and prepare for this for next week, but see which teams were beneficiaries and which teams were hurt by the fast pace, and if they're going to make any adjustments and if that's represented in number of possessions. Because I think that would be kind of a really cool thing, the difference in possessions from Georgetown to Notre Dame, when Notre Dame played Georgetown to when Notre Dame played Maryland. I think that'd be a fascinating kind of stat to track. And then almost an ancillary point, geez, is...
British? Ancillary?
Ancillary, yeah. Right. Bruv, isn't it? It's just the depth that goes along with that. So overall, Notre Dame made great adjustments. I loved what they did. But it's going to be a recurring theme on can teams make adjustments to the pace, because I thought the biggest upset, second biggest, was the game that we're going to talk about next.
Do you have anything else to add when it comes to the Fighting Irish rebounding from their loss to Georgetown?
No, other than, you know, it's funny to see everybody come out of the woodworks and dogpile on the ACC after literally one bad weekend. And then the ACC was like, okay, we kind of got our make-a-wish, our charity. We let everybody think that we stink, and then we came out and slapped everybody around today. So that's the only antagonist that I'll play.
So I might as well just explain that the plan that I laid out last week in terms of driving down to North Carolina, hitting the Duke-Penn game and the Carolina-Princeton game, and then going to Virginia Hopkins on Saturday and
plan.
Coming home, I did, right? And I went with Kevin Brown and Dan Abern. So the IL crew was in full force. Drove about 800 miles in 36 hours, which definitely took a toll on your boy. But bringing the energy for this podcast. And a lot of it is, I guess, attributable to how impressive Johns Hopkins was against Virginia. And they ended up winning 16-14. And yeah, it was awesome. So can you set the table a little bit?
Yeah. So this was, I don't know, this was kind of the start of what I thought was going to be the downfall of the ACC for the weekend. Because not only did a blue blood ACC lose, but it was to the most insufferable fan base. You had to hear that stupid song 100 times in a row. But it was a wild game from start to finish. Back and forth affair. It was 5-5, and then UVA led 10-8 at half. And kind of like a tale of two paces almost. It was really heavy back and forth in the first half. And then it slowed down a little bit in the second half. And even after the game, Hopkins head coach Milliman was saying that that was kind of like a key to their success, was not trying to go depth for depth, transition for transition against Virginia. Gobriel was out, which is Virginia's faceoff man, and that played a huge factor, not just to stop UVA's runs, but to have a few of their own. So the two examples that highlight that the best, UVA was on a 4-0 run, Hopkins wins a faceoff, goes down and scores. But then in the late third quarter, early fourth quarter, not only can they plug those runs, but they can go on runs of their own. So when you're playing make it, take it, that's really when the tide started to turn. And it went from, okay, is UVA going to separate and win this, to, oh, Hopkins is actually here to play. There are 100 other things that we could talk about with this storyline. Chase Ireland, Hopkins first line middies, Schellenberger playing out of his mind, Hopkins depth, which you think depth, you think Virginia, but Hopkins proved that. Terry, how much do you like the Hopkins goal song?
I love it when Mikey Diggs tape overlays it on that meme, yeah, and then it actually yeah works. Like, the end is like so on beat. You're like, this is incredible. It's the same meme that we talked about last week when it came to the Maxine rush over the green screen turf situation. Yep. So yeah, I love it in that context. When they actually do it at the game, I don't like it at all. It's really annoying. Okay. But yeah, man, this was what college lacrosse is all about, right? Like, it's going to sound snooty, it's going to sound silly, and you know, listen, I went to Loyola, so I'm not here to pray at the altar of the what's the fraternal order that has like the
Illuminati?
Well, kind of. They have the seeing eye in the pyramid. Do you know what I'm talking
about? Nicolas Cage?
Yes. I'm not here to pray at the altar of Nicolas Cage conspiracy theories. But with that being said, these teams have played each other 99 times. They play for the Doyle Smith Cup, which is exactly as bougie. That's what I felt when I was walking through the Virginia tailgate. I was just like, I saw the first thing I saw when I pulled in was like an 80-year-old couple walking down like the parking lot to go to where their tailgate was, and they were just carrying two bottles of champagne at like 11 a.m. on a Saturday. I was like, this is so like, perfect.
Yeah.
Like there are more cheese and grapes consumed at a Virginia tailgate than beers. Like, I firmly believe that. In any case,
that's one of the most vicious chirps I've ever heard in my entire life, and I love that you're bringing the heat.
With all that being said, this game is what college lacrosse is all about. It was awesome. So I was part of the interview that you referenced in terms of Pete talking about how you have to manage the pace against Virginia. I made like a very, this is the podcast of tortured analogies. We've already killed all of the football lacrosse like ridiculousness. The analogy that I made about playing against Virginia is like it's getting swept up in an undertow, something you know very well about. when you get swept up in an undertow, you have to swim sideways, like with the coastline in order to get out of, or rip current or whatever, in order to get out of it. And then you have to get back to the shore. And so that was kind of the point, was like withstanding and getting stops, that's the equivalent of swimming sideways. But then scoring and counteracting their runs, that's swimming back to shore. And they're two different things, and they require the same thing. It was really funny, because when I said it the first time, Pete was like, oh, that's a good analogy. And then when I started to explain a little bit more, he's like, no, it's really dumb. I was like, all right, cool, sounds good. But that was what I came away so impressed by. And I think that there's nobody who can give us better insight into exactly how Hopkins was able to, A, respond with composure, and B, respond without any fear. Then Chase Ireland, the goalie, who got to be a part of stopping the Virginia onslaughts and watch as his offense got them back in the game and then gave him a lead that he was able to protect on the stretch. Chase, how's it going, man?
Doing good. How are you guys doing?
Awesome. Glad to have you.
Chase, that's enough out of you.
Yeah.
Buddy. So there's a couple different layers here before we actually ask about the game, as your brother is FaceTiming me currently. Yeah. Which
should
is
we
interesting.
Answer it?
Yeah, yeah. We'll answer it. Why not?
Hey, everyone.
Hello, TD. How are you?
Middle of anything, are you?
No, we're not in the middle of anything. You're not interrupting anything, but thanks for tuning in and calling.
Chase, what are you doing there?
Terry and Nick just being good guys, so reaching out. This is good. Talking lax.
Good. You sing the fight song yet?
No, I haven't.
TD, what was the meanest thing you ever did to Chase growing up? Like, did you bully him at all?
All the time. Speaking of which, Chase, so who is your favorite sibling between me or Doyle? But name has to start with a T.
Yeah, it's still Doyle, though. Yeah, she's mom and dad's favorite too, so it's all right. Me and TD are fighting for last place.
Collecting bronze medals out here. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, got it. Well, TD, thanks for tuning in and ruining everything. It was great to see you last night, and I'll send you a Venmo request for the beers that I spotted you. Thank you.
Yeah, I knew as soon as I found TD texting me last night saying he was with Acello, I was like, oh boy, this is gonna be good.
Okay, so sorry, we're totally derailing it. That's why you come to the tailgate. Little professional, you know, little unprofessional. Terry, let's get this back on track, and can we get Chase a decent question before I continue my campaign to derail this entire interview?
Sure. Chase, before we get to all that stuff that I talked about in terms of how impressive your team was with the way that you guys responded, I want to ask the question that I felt earlier in the game, which is when Connor Schellenberger, McCabe Millen, and Griffin Schutz, and Peyton Cormier are just getting hands-free from 12 yards and going, like, high to high. How do you, like, what, it's undefendable. It's indefensible. Yeah. Like, how do you, like, just kind of, like, do it? How do you stand in there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, like, when you play a team like Virginia, you know, in the top teams in Division I lacrosse, like, They're star players and they're athletes. Like, they're going to get their chances. And I think it's just hanging in there, hanging with the punches, and, you know, managing the runs, right? We always talk about lacrosse as a game of runs. And, you know, they got a couple, and we were just trying to respond and again, stick with it. But, you know, those guys are, especially at Virginia for the last, you know, however many years, are just so talented and a lot of great players. So just trying to hang in there and – you know, soak those runs they had, and then kind of respond with their own. And you know, luckily made some adjustments at halftime, and kind of came out and executed. So, yeah.
What were some of those adjustments specifically?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was just kind of the middle of the field. They had a lot of transition opportunities in the first half of the game, and they thrive off that. And so, trying to kind of get to 6-on-6 sets with their offense, I think, you know, we felt good about that, and we felt like we could, you know, defend them to late into the shot clock, and I think for the most part in that second half we did a pretty good job at that, and, you know, didn't give up too many, you know, clean saves from Nunes over the top, you know, to a ton of fast breaks. So
yeah, you just played right into our hand. That's exactly what we were talking about right before this. Great
perfect,
answer.
Perfect.
So, all right, when the ball settled down, you had Scott Smith, and he obviously has been a presence on the defensive end for the Blue Jays for the entirety of his career. Mm-hmm. And then Bowden Zulik had, like, the most statistically productive game, I think, of his entire career. What did those guys do for you defensively?
Yeah, I think both those guys have been awesome, you know, throughout the years, as well as the rest of our kind of defense. You know, we kind of pride ourselves on, you know, showing up to work every day and getting better and improving, and I think – especially with Bo and Scott, like you highlighted, like they're awesome players, great teammates, and they just give me as a goalie, you know, just a level of comfortability knowing that, you know, I have those guys specifically, and, you know, our rope and the other guys out there too that are going to help me, you know, help our team, you know, give up some shots from the outside, not as many looks inside, and you know, ton of rebounds too. I think that was personally. Some of the saves I got to kind of were bouncing around in the middle, and those guys seem to be coming up with those rebounds and getting out. So
we're not allowed to say the names of short stick D-middies on this podcast, but yeah. You guys have a lot of good ones. And
yeah.
I thought that number 10, he's a transfer from Syracuse. So a player like you who's getting to, you know this team, find his role. I thought he had his best game as a Blue Jay yesterday. What's it like coming in with somebody like that whose name might rhyme with, like, Schmandin Convilis and then find a role, particularly in a game like that?
Yeah, no, BA, it's awesome to see, you know, myself, Jacob Stabner, some of these kind of grad transfers on the back end. Like, I think it's just building that comfortability. We've played at one place for 4 or 5 years and you know, kind of getting our wings here and getting comfortable playing in a new jersey and with a bunch of new teammates. So I think, you know, through 6 games so far, I think our chemistry and everything is built. And it was nice to see BA have a great game. And, you know, he works hard and he's a great guy as well. So I was super happy for him. And you know, hopefully we keep this thing rolling and again build that comfortability going forward.
So I know that you're probably going to give us an SID answer that's trained and whatever, but there are always those games where you're like, this team has too much hype. Another coach might have called this team filled with pretty boys. There's kind of like some interesting storylines going here. When you were taking the field, and I have a follow-up to this, is this a game that you had circled on your calendar as like, let's set the tone and show these assholes what Hopkins lacrosse is all about for 2024?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I won't kind of use what the other stuff has been said, but like it's fun to just play in those environments against a really good team in a cool venue, you know, at Klockner, against a historic program. And you know it's going to be a battle. You know it's going to be punches thrown either way. And, you know, I think as competitors and just loving the game of lacrosse, you know, we were excited for that game. And the nice part, too, is one thing we kind of talk about at Hopkins is we, you know, we view kind of all our games like that. You know, we play Syracuse coming up here next weekend. That's going to be another great atmosphere as well. You know, we turn around and we have our Big Ten slate coming up in the second half of the year. So those games are going to be huge as well. So I think just the moments or, you know, the competitive games against really good teams, really good coaches, you know, and we have a lot of belief in ourselves. So we know it's a, again, like I said, going to be an awesome, you know, event to be a part of and just go out there and compete and kind of love the game and love that opportunity you have.
Yeah, no, and thank you for saying that, you know, we try to treat all games like that. That's a great lie. So when you're suiting up against Rutgers versus Virginia, I'm really sure that it's the same mentality. So the second question is more schematics-wise. So you're more comfortable wanting to slow it down, getting in those six-on-six, mm-hmm. and almost preventing Virginia from being, you know, a team that can run and gun. Is that going to be a consistent theme moving forward? Are you the team that kind of wants to settle into those 6-on-6 sets, or do you have comfortability? And from what you've seen in practice, you have no problem getting into a track meet if it, you know, ends up being that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, started the first part with Virginia, obviously they've thrived off that over the years. And so, definitely trying to get to 6-on-6 as best we can. But I think that's been a theme for us, you know, on the defensive side of the ball. Just try and, you know, stop, limit their transition. Let's try to play teams, you know, in settled sets on defense. And we've been trying to pick up kind of the pace with our own transition and generating more transition. So I think we're just going to keep building at it. I don't have a set answer. I'm sure, you know, schematics will probably change week to week. But, you know, obviously try to limit the other teams and try to get some for us. But,
groundbreaking stuff.
Chase. Yeah, I know.
Groundbreaking. It's really good.
No, all right.
Pretty vanilla for you.
I think I can set this up. All right, so you guys take a 5-3 lead, and all of a sudden it's like, all right, we're in this, right? Like, we're not going anywhere. And then they score 4 straight, and now it's a 7-5 game. You go back and forth, and you kind of trade punches, and then they separated a little bit. It's 12-10 mm-hmm. with about 5 minutes to go in the third quarter. And from that point, you win 5 straight faceoffs and you score 4 straight goals. So you flip the game, right? You essentially, you go from down 2 to up 2, and then it becomes like there's 12 and a half minutes left. Nobody scored for 6 minutes. And I think at that point, then the belief starts mm-hmm. to like this is a game that we can win. We have to hold on to this.
Yeah.
So they score, cut it to 1, right? Jacob Angelo scores a man down goal. How mm-hmm. important was that? What did that moment feel like? And then when Virginia responds 6 seconds later, was it completely undone or was not, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I get that. It's like we always, you know, again, like we have a lot of belief in ourselves and in our team. And so even when we were down goals, we knew if we could kind of just hang with the punches a little bit, you know, starts with one stop on defense or one ground ball off the faceoff and one great pass on offense that leads to a goal. And so I think we were concerned kind of with just making the next simple play, the best we could. And then obviously those huge goals down the stretch, you know, especially being man down, we get that face off, I think, and we're running around the possession a little bit, and Angel just makes a great little backdoor cut, and, you know, again, a simple play, and forgot who passed him the ball. Was it Dylan Bauer, Peschko, one of those guys. But Peschko, yeah, like, again, him to have confidence in Angel to know he's going to catch that ball, and then Peschko to have confidence to throw that ball. So, yeah, that was crucial, and our offense did a great job kind of giving us a little breathing room on the defensive end. Like, all right, you know, we just scored one. We're up two now. You know, obviously they responded, and we were able to handle it from there. But, yeah, definitely it was – I felt like complimentary lacrosse kind of down the stretch. Them giving us that two-goal buffer most of that fourth quarter, and then, you know, us getting some simple stops.
So final whistle blows, and you went crazy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It was almost as if you were trying to tell the rest of your teammates, like, let's go. Yeah, celebrate harder. Yeah. This is huge.
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough venue to go into and against a great team and get a – I think it was our first top two win. I saw, like, the graphic in, like, 5 or 6 years. So, like, it was just a fun game and an awesome experience and super grateful. And I think, you know, it's hard to win lacrosse games. It's hard to win lacrosse games against really good teams. So, you know, getting that belief and just getting that kind of energy up and not that it was down, but, yeah, I guess it was just letting the emotions fly a little bit.
It almost, like, just from my position where I was watching, it was kind of like, it was like your teammates didn't even necessarily, like, register the game was over. You know what I mean? Like, because the last, like, couple minutes were so frantic. Like, I think you it was two full field heaves, which ended up being the right play. Like, oftentimes that's not, but it was in both settings or both situations. And so, like, once it kind of, like, final whistle, it was like, yeah, we actually did it. That was the way it resonated with me. And it was cool because there's another side to that coin where it's like, yeah, we won, but, you know, there's like a business as usual, and this isn't our final goal, right? So you got to balance it where it's like, to your point, it's hard, so you have to savor it.
Sure,
but at the same time, like, you know, we didn't put on the pads on January 2nd with the goal of beating, you know, Virginia on March 1st. Like, we have loftier goals than this.
Yeah, definitely. I think that kind of speaks to the composure and, you know, like you said, those big goals that we have. And it was nice to get better last week, come out with a win and keep it moving forward. And, you know, we're like trying to build this thing in late May. So, you know, again, like I said, hopefully keep this rolling and continue getting better each game, each week.
A couple bigger picture ones before we let you go. The first is, so you mentioned you're a grad transfer from Cornell. You had the pick of pretty much anywhere that you could have gone. You're playing for the coach that recruited you to Ithaca. It would be easy to just assume that that's why you decided to go to Hopkins, but why did you decide to go to Hopkins?
Yeah, I think that it was part of that is definitely true of the familiarity with, you know, Coach Milliman, but it was also, you know, it was besides him, it was coaches that I haven't met before, didn't have a great relationship with, or I just didn't know yet, rather. And so I think the familiarity with the coaching staff, when I came down and visited and talked to Coach K on the defensive side of the ball, Coach Brian Kelly, Coach Cohen as well, and Coach Crawley, honestly, was one who gave me a kind of a great perspective of what it's like to play at Hopkins and what it means, you know, because those guys have played there before. So I think building a relationship with the staff and kind of bonding with them pretty quickly and, you know, realizing that we had some similar things in mind and how we like to go about the game of lacrosse and kind of what it means to us and the ultimate goal. And then it was the other half was the guys on the team. I knew Logan Callahan and Casey McDermott from Rochester back home. And, you know, Logan was kind of like a little brother and his older brother and TD actually are still best buddies till this day. So it was nice to kind of reconnect with those guys. And you know, I said, if we got a bunch of guys like Casey McDermott and Logan on this team, I think it's going to go pretty well. So, and then obviously meeting some guys, just texting and actually my roommate is Bowden. And so he was the first guy I met outside of those Rochester guys. And we kind of kicked it off on the right foot. So, yeah.
And then the last one for me is, you know, the weather in Baltimore is not great, but it is a lot better than the weather in Ithaca. How much less does the ball hurt when you get hit with it in January down here than it does up there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point. And you know, I always joke with my teammates, like I tell them I'm in the deep south now, because for the first 23 years I was No further south than Ithaca, New York. But yeah, it's definitely nice. Like today was 65 and sunny, so I couldn't complain too much. But yeah, it's pretty good when the sun doesn't come out, or when the sun comes out before, you know, April.
Got it. And then last question for me, I'm going to give you a chance because it's weird being, I guess, like a bit of a father figure to you and TD.
Yeah.
You know, it's a sign of great respect that you have that view of me. So I don't know if you watched TD's game versus the San Diego Seals last night, but he started off really good.
Yep.
And then he kind of played like crap in the second half.
Yeah.
Do you think that you can take some of that Hopkins magic where you play better in the second half
almost
switch roles and be an older brother slash potential guidance counselor to him?
Yeah, no, I caught a little bit of TD's game. I knew it was a big matchup with the teams, obviously, with San Diego being awesome, but also too with him and Trevor at the dot. So
and the broadcast crew.
And the broadcast crew is right.
That's
Can't forget
right.
that. No, I mean, TD's he's a pro and he knows what he has to do in those adjustments. Yeah,
technically,
so.
He's a pro.
Right.
Last night.
Yeah.
And then, sorry, last one because we do have to get rolling. This one's from a fan. Tristan from Ithaca asks, how have you been in a strength and conditioning college program for 6 years and still don't have calf muscles?
Yeah, I don't know. You might have to ask Coach Jay Dyer about that one. But the sweats are going to stay on as long as they possibly can. So hopefully get a couple extra saves. And yeah.
It's going to be tough in the deep south. You're going to get those sweats.
Yeah, right?
It's going to be gross.
Yeah, exactly. So, man. I can't wait till TD gets on here. I'm gonna have to come up with some stuff. So I'll get him back.
We'll get him.
Just give me a heads up. I'll get him back.
Chase, we really appreciate you joining us on the podcast, man. Congratulations on the win over the Cavaliers. Good luck against the Orange in Charlotte, North Carolina next Saturday. And we look forward to watching you make a bunch more saves down the stretch of this Blue Jay season.
All righty. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
You got it. See you, bud.
What a nice kid. Just cheerful, jolly. I've only met him in person once, and like you walk into the room and he just, it's like a dog. Like he just smiles and gets excited. He's like, someone's here. Who is it? Hi, I'm Chase. And I'm like, dude, give me a hug. So I hope, and just for the record, I'll touch base with Terry after this, but I hope that I'm trying to find this balance of professionalism but funny, but with an Ireland on, I'm like, oh God, I really tried to keep it more professional than just bullying him for 20 minutes.
The most unprofessional thing you did was hold the camera so that only TD could see his brother and we couldn't see him at all. So.
I realized that like 30 seconds in and I'm like, oh, what an idiot. That's a rookie mistake. So I apologize to anybody who might try and clip that later.
Nick, let's keep it moving. There is... a lot more lacrosse action this weekend.
So much lacrosse action. What a weekend it was. These are the weekends that we live for. I thought that this was the biggest upset of the weekend, Penn-Duke. So
yes.
Penn wins 14-12. The most surprising victory, the most unexpected victory, the most unfortunate for Princeton victory, which we'll talk about in a second. But it seems to me that Penn's addiction to close games – trumps any team's roster anywhere at all. They could play the 96 Bulls and lose by two. They can play Duke and win by two. So I feel like Penn had a good 1-2-3 punch. One being Lavelle covering O'Neal, limiting him to one goal, was an all-time performance. The second is Penn's ride causing some mayhem and turnovers. And the third was their face-off game tilting in their favor. So limiting O'Neal, causing mayhem and making it difficult for Duke to clear, as well as winning the face-off game, I thought were the three factors that Penn leveraged to walk away with the victory. And then it was interesting towards the end because Denenza scored three at the end of the game, ultimately making it a one-goal game before Penn won the faceoff and scored an empty netter to ultimately make the final 14-12. But, Terry, how surprised were you at this result?
I mean, Are you going to call me a liar if I say that not that surprised? Because
no, I would never call you a liar.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's exactly what you said to start, and it's exactly what I said last week, and it's exactly what we've been talking about when it comes to Penn the whole season and for the 3 years that we've been doing this podcast. This is just who they are. Now, granted, they got smoked by Carolina. Actually, they didn't. It was a pretty close game against Carolina, but they lost on Sunday. And yeah, both these, you know, so Princeton beat Carolina, and then they lost to Duke significantly on Sunday. So these results flipped themselves. Oh, man, I wanted to ask Chase about what it felt like to kill the ACC. Damn it. You think we'll get him back on?
Can't. Because he didn't.
Yes, he did. Just because it resurrected on Sunday. It was definitely in the tomb for overnight. And then
Which
Mary
is
Magdalene
a
came
classic
and said, hello,
Notre
ACC,
Dame story.
Rise from the ashes.
Yeah.
All right. In any case, that was pretty secularist. I hope I don't get struck down. Anyway, Penn scored on 18% of their offensive possessions. Duke has never lost a game since Ron Caputo has been there or been the defensive coordinator when they got stops on 82% of their settled 6-on-6 defensive possessions. They've never lost. Conversely, they scored on 40% of their settled offensive possessions. This game was won in the middle of the field and by virtue of unsettled goals. And there's a lot of reasons why. I think that if you talk to the Duke staff, they would attribute most of their failure in the clearing game to their inability to diagnose the type of ride Penn was in. And so their fluctuation, their switching between a 9-man and a drop gave them a lot of problems. And there were instances in which, you know, they had attackmen crossing the midline and getting into that spot to get the open pass, and the guy with the ball never threw it to him. They had, you know, guys that were carrying up fields that ran when they should have thrown, threw when they should have ran. They had guys going off sides for inexplicable reasons. So it was just, I think, and what's interesting is the difference between being there in person and watching on TV or your computer. And being there in person, the thing that really stood out was in Aiden McGuire, Jack Gray, Ben Johnston, and Max Sloat, who's a redshirt freshman offensive midfielder from California, Duke has four guys who are young, two short stick DMs, two offensive midfielders, and they're absolute monsters physically, right? And these are highly recruited players, so it's not as if these are surprises. It's just that in the context and in contrast to a lot of their teammates, it's like, no, these are the, you know, purebred ACC midfielders. But they're young, and these were the guys that made the mistakes in the middle of the field. Like, Sloat got an earful once when he didn't get back from Dino, and it led to a Tyler Keel assisted goal. And then there were a couple of the plays where, whether it was McGuire or Gray, like, they didn't make the right diagnosis in terms of throwing the ball forward. And so, you know, two-goal game. Also, Emmett Carroll, to the point about the difference of being there in person versus, you know, having watched via video, like, that kid's a lot taller than I realized. And not that it matters that much, but in terms of, like, a fill-up-the-cage type situation, you know, we've talked a lot about goalies on this podcast so far this year, and I think that, you know, I'm sticking with my Entenmann and McNaney as the 1-2, and then I think, you know, the 3-4 is probably, like, a little bit more closely defined from a Gianfrancaro. Will Mark probably came into the season in that conversation. I don't think he's necessarily played at that level. And then, you know, from that 5 through 9 to 12 range, there's a bunch of dudes, and I think Emma Carroll is absolutely right there within them. You know, Brennan Lavelle guarding Brennan O'Neill was an interesting one, because I think that there were a lot of flaws in Duke's approach schematically, particularly when it came to getting O'Neill involved. But at the same time, he went 1-for-8 shooting, right? So, you know, it's not as if I can take anything away from the defensive performance that limited him. It was just that I thought that there was maybe more that could be done in order to get him open, get him into, you know, better, get him into situations where he was going to be able to utilize what he's good at more effectively than what Duke ended up doing. And then you saw some of that on Sunday with their bounce back performance against the Tigers. So, yeah, it was a really compelling game with a lot to unpack, but also it was even if it weren't a game where there was another game 2 days later, it was always going to be a game where you need to analyze it in isolation, because it was going to be a reflection of the things that Duke was going to address in the subsequent practices, and you probably weren't going to see it again, as opposed to this is a trend that you're going to be able to see going forward. If there were something that I would be concerned about, it's the same thing I've been concerned about with Duke, you know, basically for the last few years, which is how do they handle adversity, right? But aside from that, you know, tactically, what we saw from the Blue Devils, you know, they're going to be fine. And then conversely, with Penn, you know, how much do they give back by virtue of this loss to Carolina? I mean, it kind of depends on how good you want to think Penn is. The first is they're not going to run by anybody at the attack, right? And so there are some folks who will just always believe that puts a really low ceiling on who you can be. But they are really creative. They are incredibly accurate shooters. And they move the ball so quickly that it compounds with how quick they are athletically. And so, you know, it's crazy how much they've evolved in 1 year. You know, even though they still have a couple monsters in Gabe Fury and James Shipley on the team, they don't have the same identity as being the behemoth midfielders just because Sam Hanley is not on the roster anymore relative to what they were last year. And so now they're much quicker and they move the ball much quicker. It's a remarkable transformation in a one-to-one, a year-to-year evolution. And it will define how good they end up being. But having beaten Duke, like, I don't think that their ceiling is higher than I would have thought it was before that game. I think it's
really,
you know, they're still, yeah, I mean, it is in the sense of their NCAA tournament resume, but in terms of how good is this team actually, like, they beat Duke. You can make the argument that that means that, yeah, they're probably a top five team. I don't see it that way. I think that they're an 8-16 team, you know, depending on how two or three of these one goal games go going forward. And that's exactly who I thought they've been all year. So I'm not going to overreact to this one, even though I felt like that we learned a lot about them. We learned a lot about who they can be, but not necessarily who they are, you know. And again, because 2 days later, they ended up losing to a Carolina team that just didn't look good against Princeton.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting to start with Duke playing young studs, like, you know, the couple of guys that you mentioned. There are going to be some ricochet consequences for better or worse. And I remember reading a quote from Donowski after the game where he was like, I wish we would have been better in the clearing 7 weeks into this practice. I think that was the gist of it.
No,
that's correct
what
me if I'm wrong. And I think back to my freshman year. And what's funny is now when I sit around with my teammates or when I meet somebody, you know, pro teammates, we talk about the differences in college coaches and things like that. And freshman year, you're kind of just the entire time, unless you're truly one of the rare breeds, which is like one or two people a year, it does not apply to anybody that I'm talking about. You're kind of just hanging on by a thread and you're kind of just like deer in the headlights going, oh shit, a car's coming at me. I just got to figure out how to avoid and get through the next 10 seconds of whatever set this is. So I almost think it's one of those good things that will pay off in the long run. What mistakes do you want to be making right now versus what mistakes do you want to be avoiding in May? And where do those priorities lie? If you drop one to a decent Penn team because your clear might not be as dialed, that's certainly playing a factor. Some face-off stuff that you can dial in. Young guys getting experience in a high-level game with the clear. I think that's one of the most valuable inputs, because not only can you tailor that in practice and actually have film of like, guys, we know that we can lose a game if we don't clear effectively. Here's what we need to do in practice. It ups the stakes a little bit, because writing and clearing is usually when, I know I certainly started zoning out as a player, going, okay, coach, I'll just get it and run. Can't do that anymore. And then getting those guys comfortable so that everybody's on the same page and avoiding those losses. It's the classic Duke tale as old as time story. Donowski loses one, is going to use that as a way to sharpen the tool belt. Not only did we see that happen a couple days later, but I think we're going to see that happen throughout the rest of the year as well.
Yeah, it's funny because everybody reacted to the fact that the loss happened on March 1st, which was kind of March 2nd because of Leap Day. That being said, the point is still the same, right? And, you know, the simple fact is, I don't know that any of the teams they played in February were good enough to beat them relative to how good they were in years prior when they did beat them. So, you know, it was coming. They're Duke.
And speaking of it was coming, let's just get right into Duke Princeton. The Great League course, so not so fast, my friend. Hey, Duke loses the Penn and then says, I'm actually mad. And I was thinking about what I could use as an analogy for this. Terry, can you give me a classic like 70s, 80s, the nerds pulled one over on the bully in the school? Any movies like that that pop to mind?
Well, Revenge of the Nerds.
Revenge of the Nerds. You want to know why there's not a good Revenge of the Nerds 2?
I mean, there is, but go on.
Not a good one or a realistic one.
Why?
Because the bullies showed up the next day and just beat the shit out of them in the hallways.
Put their heads right in the toilet, for sure.
Put their heads right in the toilet. So, unfortunately, and I think it was a great article. I don't know who wrote it, but it was like, it started off.
The beauty of Revenge of the Nerds 2?
No, it wasn't about it. We'll talk about movies in a second, and then we'll make World War II references. But it was like Penn beats Duke, and everybody was happy about it except for Princeton, who had to face them a couple days later. Final score ended up being 17-8.
Yeah.
And Princeton was coming off a team or a win over UNC, which we'll talk about that later. But bottom line, exactly what we just talked about. They cleaned up some of the transition, cleaned up some of the face-off blunders, and took out their frustrations on a good old-fashioned game of bully the nerds at recess. Anything to take away here?
Candidly, no, because so this one, Carolina Penn and Notre Dame Maryland all were at noon. And I was fortunate because I've got a three-screen situation here, and so I was watching all of them. But at the same time, like Duke was up 9-1. Before I was really even settled in. So I kind of at that point was just like, whatever. I don't know. I was just kind of like always in the corner of my eyes. So, you know, the attack was dominant. Josh Wada, 4 goals, 2 assists. Dyson Williams, 5 goals. O'Neal, 2-2 on 7 shots. So, you know, it wasn't as if they had an incredible performance. We didn't really talk about Aiden Denenza having his 3-goal stretch there to cut the game to 1. We didn't really talk about it because I don't know that there's a ton of analysis other than he's a good player.
Other than three goals, bro.
Yeah. And, you know, they were just playing free because they knew that the game was lost at that point. So, you know, there was no fear of a negative outcome, right? There was no reason to be afraid. And so that was kind of why they played that way. So, yeah, I think the challenge for me is a combination of why did Princeton only score 8 goals in total and why did they really only score like 3-4 goals before the game was like really out of reach? And what are the question marks with their offense? You know, right now, the most obvious question is, well, I guess there's kind of two that they're tied. So, and it's funny because they can kind of be a strength as much as they can be a weakness. But so one of their question marks is they're starting 2 freshmen at attack. Which means that, like, you don't know what you're going to get on a game-to-game basis because freshmen are inherently inconsistent. And then the second thing is that they are still figuring out who belongs with whom in terms of the structure of their top 2 midfield lines. They don't have, like, a bona fide 40, 50-point score from the midfield the way that Sammy English was for the last couple seasons or Alexander Verdara was last year. So as a result, like, it's not as if they're going to try to get their first midfield out 2/3, 80% of the time, whatever the case may be, and they know who's going to get the pole. It's much more whack-a-mole, which, again, it's a strength and a weakness. It's a strength in the sense that it's hard for your opponent to prepare for who they need to defend. It's a weakness because you don't know who to turn to when the going gets tough and you need a goal. And so the short answer is that for Princeton, offense is going to be a learning curve. It's going to be a work in progress. And so it clicked on Friday night, largely thanks to a combination of, you know, a momentum-changing Coulter Mackesy 60-yard goal that broke the 10-man ride. And then once Carolina dropped out of the 10-man, then there was a 3-goal run right at the end of the second quarter that effectively won the game for Princeton. Now, I was impressed late, I think it was late in the third, but it might have been early in the fourth, when after Carolina cut it to 3, Quinn Kramer came out and just did one of those things, zero pass possession, right out of the box, like just run to the middle of the field, take a shot and score. And then the next goal was Colin Molshine in transition, which was an incredible juice goal. I took very strong note of how the bench responded to Colin Molshine's goal. That team really likes him, or he just went through something and they were very happy for him. That was like, and then also he like stayed down on the field because he like had like a double hamstring cramp at the same time. Kind of looked like he was giving birth. It looked terribly uncomfortable. So prayers up for Colin Molshine. So basically they won the game in the middle of, or at the end of the second quarter, and then they prevented themselves from potentially losing the game in that sequence. And so came away really, really impressed by Princeton, but, not a ton to take away from the Princeton side of the loss to Duke, because by the same token, when there were three games going on at the same time, I wasn't paying very close attention to that one either.
And it's shocking that we have so many games to talk about that it took this long into the episode to talk about maybe the best one. And before we do it, I just wanted to make the note because I forgot to. Anytime I read Danenza's name,
yeah,
I think of D'Annunzio from Caddyshack. And I just hope that there's some similarities in personality because he'd be my favorite player. But it wasn't the upset of the week, but there actually is.
I can send you, I will send you a screenshot after this.
Please
that
do.
Would reaffirm that there is.
Okay, good. I'm very glad to hear that. But Penn State, Yale, comeback of the century of the first weekend of March in 2024. Penn State beats Yale 15-14. What on earth was this game? So Jake Morin played hero, scored with 59 seconds left in overtime. But this was the highlight of a tale of two halves. Yale just dominated the first half. It was 13-8 with 2:25 remaining in the third. And it was just two games within the game. First half all Yale, Penn State not looking great. And then they flipped the script and just went on an absolute runner, an absolute heater. And Terry, I'll let you get into the details, but what a game this one was. My goodness.
Yeah, it was wild. It was one of those games where Yale built that lead. Penn State came out of halftime and cut right into it, got to 9-5, 9-6, somewhere in that range. And then Yale answered two of the runs of momentum. And it just felt like, yeah, Penn State is going to put in a game effort, but there's no way that Yale is going to lose this. And it really felt that way until the 14th goal that actually tied it and sent it to overtime. And both teams had the ball twice in overtime. Penn State obviously scored on their second possession. So even in overtime, kind of felt like there was an opportunity that Yale was going to be able to win. So everybody made a big deal out of, rightfully, Matt Brandau putting up 13 points against Colgate in a game that nobody saw. What got less attention was that Patrick Pisano picked up 10 ground balls. And I watched the tape of that game after it was over. And so I have spoken to Andy Shea over the course of the last 6-9 months about why they have struggled to form a defensive identity since losing the brother of, or I guess actually since gaining the brother of our prior podcast host, or guest, excuse me, that being TD Erlin. And basically, once he arrived, it was kind of like, well, we don't have to play defense anymore because we're never going to have to play defense because he's going to win 80% of the faceoffs. I have watched Yale over the last 2 years and come away with the conclusion or opinion that they're very good at matching feet, staying in front, all that sort of stuff, and they're very bad at killing possessions. It felt like disproportionately when a rebound was loose in the middle of the field or a pass got knocked down in the middle of the field or whatever, basically the ball was kind of always bouncing the other team's way, and it was finding itself to a completely open shooter on the backside who was just going to can a 10-yard time and room, step down with nobody on him and nobody between him and the goal. Patrick Pisano, through the first two games against Villanova, or really through the first 2.5 games, looked like the defensive player that was going to rectify that for the Bulldogs. Talking to Jeff Tambroni about this game afterward and posing that idea to him, he agreed in the sense that it felt like they played so much cleaner in the second half that those second chance loose ball opportunities just didn't present themselves, right? They were scoring before the defense had to make or had an opportunity to make a play like that in order to kill the possession. And so he attributed it to a combination of, you know, the leaders, right? So TJ Malone, who finished with 9 points, Jake Moran, who you mentioned scored the game winner, Matt Costin, who I think had 3, seniors who just know how to win. And what they talked about at halftime, his comment was like, they acted it, right? They didn't just say it. And there was tremendous value there, and it was really impressive. And so a big win for the Nittany Lions, especially right as they continue to kind of build the resume in the wake of their season opening loss to Colgate and not let their season get derailed as a result of that. And so, you know, for the Bulldogs, the first element is they are continuing to figure out who they are in the wake of not having Leo Johnson and Chris Lyons. But there's also more to it than that. I do think that they have some answers defensively, and now it goes from who are we, can we play defense, to now we have to play defense for 60 minutes, right? 30 minutes isn't going to cut it against a good team. And then, you know, on the other end, there's also some questions around getting the ball from defense to offense and having those midfielders that are going to be able to athletically transcend and take them to the next level. So I think if you're a Yale fan, that's what you're going to be looking forward to as they take on potentially the number one team in the country and head to the Denver Pioneers in their next game.
And what a great segue, Terry. My goodness. Just hit an hour on the pod, so let's give the people a little treat. Give me your number one. Let's just start with number one and go from there.
All right, so I'm gonna look to you for a little bit of affirmation of logic. So I think it has to start.
What a bad choice, but go
ahead.
You're
not a logician? I think it has to start from the standpoint of deserving, right? Because if you don't deserve it on the basis of what you've done, what are we doing, right? It's a combination of why do you play the games, and but at the same time, like, you also have to understand that, like, why do you play the games? Like, not everybody has played the same number of games. Not everybody has played the schedule that everybody else will play as the season goes on, et cetera, et cetera. But it's pretty clear to me that there are two teams who, at least as far as how deserving are they, rise above the rest. And it's Denver and Army, right? Because everybody else has lost. They at least have the quality wins that Harvard, for instance, or NJIT do not in order to really kind of deserve to be in this conversation. So let's just isolate it to those two teams. For me, at that point, can you just pick who you think is better, right? Or is that breaking the logic? Do you have to go all the way to the necessary conclusion of who is the most deserving? Because if it is just who's most deserving, I think it's pretty clearly Denver. But I think that there's a relatively small margin between who's most deserving between Army and Denver and then everybody else who's lost. And if you're letting me pick who's better between those two things, I think Army is better, and I actually think that very strongly. So who do I get to vote for on that basis?
If you join a team, you got to finish the season, Terry. So if you're starting off with who's the most deserving and you come to the conclusion that Denver is the most deserving but Army might be the better team, well then, unfortunately, you just mousetrapped yourself and you're going to have to stick with Denver. Unfortunately for me, I believe it's Denver as well. Army's win over Syracuse is impressive. Denver's 2 wins over Cornell and Hopkins just mean more this early into the season. What is nice, and what my favorite part about all of this, is that none of it matters. Everybody's going to still continue to play their season. The number one team tomorrow is not going to matter in 5 weeks from now. The only thing that I want to just hear your thoughts on as we wrap up, and again, I'm just going to be an ACC homer with this. Did this have any impact on what we're going to be seeing come Selection Sunday?
Yeah, no question.
No, it didn't. ACC still gets everybody. Thanks for joining. But I'll give you last actual word.
I mean, yeah, it was funny talking to Lars after the game. He's like, when I was watching on Friday night, I was like, oh no, is this 2022 all over again? Which I'm sure is exactly what you wanted to hear.
That's not what I wanted to hear, Terry. It's not what I wanted to hear.
I mean, ultimately, bro, your ACC brethren are just gonna have to win the games. That's what it comes down to.
No, I thought we were just supposed to look pretty, and that's what we did. So it was good to see North Carolina, Notre Dame, and Duke bounce back against 2 Ivies and Maryland today. But Terry, thank you so much. Love you. What an episode. What a weekend of lacrosse. I'm going to have a beer.
You should go take a United Airlines flight to LAX.
Also, I actually did just look it up. Revenge of the Nerds got a 5.1 on IMDb, or Revenge of the Nerds 2, Nerds in Paradise, which you said was a good sequel, got a 5.1. So that's the only miss. We'll be better next week.
Love you, Nick.
Love you, Jay.